When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com. The AFTP, the Agri-Food Training Partnership, is partnerships with six leading UK universities and the bridge between industry and academia, translating cutting-edge academic research into applied industry expertise. Starting this month, listeners could be doing online part-time courses in subjects as interesting and diverse as grassland systems, ruminant health and welfare, ruminant nutrition, agro-ecosystem services, soil management, or water and aquaculture. You will know just how important and relevant they all are. You can find all these courses on www.aftp.co.uk/podcast, and there's currently 25% off poultry health online for the first five places only, that is, so don't miss out with that. This course will reflect developments in poultry health and the changing areas of veterinary and technical expertise within it. And also a free short course, Trust in Food, Understanding Food Supply Systems. That starts 22nd of October and explores the challenges and responsibilities of different people in the food system, including the role of the consumer. You'll leave the course knowing more about where your food comes from and how you can make a difference in the food supply chain. Once again, that is aftp.co.uk/podcast.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to this very special Rock and Roll Farming episode 87. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading up to Scotland to talk to farmer and storyteller Doug Avery. Doug, how are you?
I'm really good, thanks, Will.
Good. And the more perceptive amongst listeners will have picked up on the fact that it isn't a Scottish accent, but it is a New Zealand one. What are you doing over here, Doug?
I'm over here to share my story with Scottish people. Mm-hmm. I'm over here to see this amazing country. I hadn't been to Scotland before. I'm over here to grow relationships. But most of all, I'm over here to help give people that are struggling with their emotional selves, to give them permission to say it's okay to say I'm not okay. We've been doing that in New Zealand for some time. Mm-hmm. One of the great challenges, and I work pretty largely in the mental health area in New Zealand, one of the great challenges with mental health is changing the relationship people have with it to see it as an opportunity rather than a problem. And when people actually can come forward and admit that they're having a bit of a struggle, well, then they're halfway to getting help.
Yeah.
and to recovery.
Absolutely. And you'll have received a warm welcome in Scotland, no doubt?
Oh, it's been beyond awesome. I just can't believe it. Everything has been as close to perfect for us as it could possibly be. We've been just so warmly welcomed, and I've met so many awesome people. It's almost unbelievable. Yeah, it is. Just awesome. What a great country.
Yeah. Have you got any Scottish heritage? Because being from New Zealand.
Yeah. My grandmother was a Graham from the border country.
Yeah. Okay.
I had the understanding that they were a fairly frisky Warren type people. I might have to watch out for the darts. No, myself from Tintagel in Cornwall, and the Averys, and my wife is Irish descent. So, you know, we are very British.
Yeah. So, but you're from Marlborough in New Zealand. Why don't you tell us a bit about that area and what it's like down there?
Yeah, Marlborough is an interesting area. It's in the lee of the Southern Alps and right up there by Cook Strait. So it encompasses about three different climate zones: the Marlborough Sounds, which are moderately wet; the centre part of Marlborough, which is pretty dry. It's in the lee of the Southern Alps, and so it doesn't get a lot of rain. Mm-hmm. And then the Kaikoura Coast, which is quite mountainous, and yeah, we've had a few big earthquakes and what have you.
Yeah.
And the awesome thing about Marlborough, of course, is Sauvignon Blanc, which is basically spun the world on its head in terms of wine. Marlborough,
yeah.
Sauvignon Blanc is taken off in Australia, taken off in this area of the world, and now taking off in America. And so there's a lot of people that made a lot of money out of growing wine.
Yeah. Well, my wife and I travelled around New Zealand a while back, a good few years ago now, but that area was just about our favourite. It's a beautiful, beautiful area, isn't it?
When I was a boy, it was completely different. And in the last 30 years, it's transformed. And I guess, you know, same with my own farm. I haven't got any grapes myself, but we probably will have in a few years. Mm. And it's an example. It's become one of the areas of some of the greatest innovation in New Zealand. And I guess my own farm and business is an example of that. So, you know, if you like innovation, if you like excitement, and if you love good food and terrific wine, it's an awesome part of New Zealand to visit.
And how long have the family been on the farm that you're on now?
It'll be 100 years since my grandfather bought the original part of Bonnevarie. Mm-hmm. Next year, it'll be 100 years. And our family, the Avery family, arrived from, they've sailed from Gravesend to Nelson on the first boat that made that journey directly. Wow. arriving on the 22nd of August 1842. So wow, that sort of gives you a bit of a scope.
Yeah. Wow. Are you having a celebration next year for the centenary?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there is no doubt about that, but we haven't actually really teed anything up yet. We don't actually know exactly what time that year that happened. So we'll probably go for an event in the middle of the year, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
Get it half right.
Yeah. And what about the farm business itself then? What have you got going on there at the moment?
Well, when my grandfather took over, bought Bonnevarie, 206 hectares in 1919, and he farmed it for about 30-odd years. And then my father came back from the war. He was a navigator and a Lancaster bomber. Got the Distinguished Flying Cross and survived 32 tours of ops across the channel. I'm incredibly lucky to be here. I think you've got a better mathematical chance of winning the New Zealand Lotto than Dad had of surviving.
Yeah.
And then he farmed for another 30-odd years. Wendy and we bought it off Mum and Dad, 206 hectares all, and around about 1,000 stock units. And then we moved off the farm. We still own 50% of it on the 20th of April this year. And the day we moved off, the property was 2,300 hectares and 19,000 stock units. So during my term, I got a bit carried away. I sort of got a bit overexcited, and the business has gone through the roof. It's an awesome business, producing the highest quality of food for the world's most discerning customers and consumers. So, pretty exciting place. But halfway through my journey, we struck an 8-year drought. I was trained to live in this dry area by my father and grandfather, but we struck a 100-year drought.
Okay.
And or 1 in 100-year drought, 1 in 400-year drought, maybe. It was an 8-year drought, and battling that got the better of my mind and broke me. And that was a very, very, very hard period of time.
Yeah. When was that? 1998, was it?
98 was sort of like 2 years into it, and that year I realised that if I didn't change the way I operated, I wouldn't survive. It was basically down to that. And one day, by all chance, I reluctantly attended a seminar in North Canterbury. A young sales rep from a stock firm said to me, I would like to take you to a field day, Doug. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, no, I'm too busy. And he said, I think it'd do you good. Get off the farm.
Yeah.
I said, what's it on? And he said, it's on Lucien. And I said, well, our family's been growing Lucien for 80 years. What would I learn? He said, it'd just do you good to get away. And I said, no, I got too much on. He said, every time I come here, you're rotting in your own juice.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick you up at 6:30 on Tuesday regardless. And he took me down there, and 5 minutes into the talk of Dr. Derek Moot, a senior professor from Lincoln University, I was asking for a pen and piece of paper. 1 hour, one day, one man changed my life. Mm. Same family, same weather, same world, but a completely different outcome started to come from there. So that's my background. That day changed my life. I've never lost hope from that day on, but before that, for a period of time, I had no hope.
Yeah.
And if human beings don't have hope, they're in a major, major crisis. So I didn't know at the time, of course, that that was happening, and the next 4 years were harder than anything I've ever been through, but I never lost sight of hope.
From when you went to the seminar then, and that obviously struck a huge chord with you. In practice, how did you initially set about changing what you were doing?
Well, the thing that he said that day, we used to graze Lucien quite a bit, but it never really did that well, and so we invariably made the crop into either baleage or hay,
yeah,
silage or hay, and we did seed off it. So my father and my grandfather had been really keen on seed, and so had I. But that day, Dr. Moot suggested that we use it as our primary grazing plant. And as he spoke, all the pennies dropped through the slot. You know, I said, oh, my gosh, I never thought about this. I never thought about that. And I guess it was just like my light just switched on.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize how hard the change would be. And over the next 4 years, we had some terrible days of despair where I wondered whether I'd actually I had nothing left after I'd started to spend on this change. For another attempt at anything. If I got this wrong, it was the finish. And fortunately, my bank stuck with me. They kind of had some sort of belief in me. But the real thing was that it switched back on my determination and my energy, you know.
Yeah.
So I self-cured during that time. And 4 years later, Moot rung me up one day. He was staying with his mother-in-law in a holiday home in the Sounds, and he said, I get a bit bored down here, Doug, and you won't know me. And I said, no. I said, bloody hell, you're like God to me. And I said, you saved my life. And he said, I wondered if I could come to your farm.
Yeah.
And boy, That was amazing. He came out, and we've been best of friends ever since. He's just been talking in Geneva, and I downloaded the video of it, and I noticed he was spending quite a bit of time talking about what happened at Bonnevere, and then he went on, and we've been electrifying dryland farming all over New Zealand. So it's an awesome story, and that's where my storytelling started. I started to get asked to do a lot of talks, and people like my talks because they're not boring. Yeah. I tell a few curly dog stories, and people like those as well. Some people don't. It's not always 100%. I've been feeling my way with the audience over here pretty conservatively, I have to say.
Yeah.
But Will, do you know what a flea is?
Yeah.
Do you realize they can jump 100 times your own height?
No, I did not, no.
Imagine what it'd be like for you and I if we could jump 100 times our own height. Wouldn't the landing be hard?
Yeah, it would.
If you get a flea and you drop it into a glass jar and put a plastic clear wrap across the top of it, it will jump and hit the clear wrap. It will jump and hit the clear wrap and fall back down. It will jump and hit the clear wrap. It won't understand what's stopping it from jumping out of that jar.
Yeah.
It knows it has the capacity to jump out of that jar. And after a while, it will simply give up.
Yeah.
Okay. And if you take the glad wrap off or the clear wrap off the top of the jar, even though it's gone and there's no restriction, the flea will just sit there. It won't jump again because it doesn't understand what's happened to its life.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to me. And that day in North Canterbury, Dr. Moat said, have another jump, but try jumping a different way. And I went straight out of the ryegrass and clover jar, which had failed me so badly, and into a new realm of lucerne and legumes. And that realm in terms of farming was just like it was like a different job, different reward, different outcomes, unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean I watched some of your presentation on YouTube the other night, and you used a phrase that really stuck with me. If you look at things in a different way, the things you look at will be different. I guess that's what you mean with that.
Yeah. If you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got.
Yeah.
And one of the things about human beings is that a lot of human beings, including myself, try to run life on their own.
Mm-hmm.
They feel that they surely have got the capacity. But I love to talk to people about the power of geese and the formation of the V that they have. And the fact that every goose in that formation contributes to the overall well-being of the group.
Yeah.
Geese get 71% more flying distance, which enables them to forage further and what have you, than if they flew on their own. And human beings can have a V of their own. So I always fly in a V these days. I never fly alone. And when you listen to geese flying over, they're always honking, and that's two things. That's the ones at the back saying, keep on flying, you wonderful leader. You're giving us a free ride. And the other more clever ones are saying, and when you need to, let me know, and I'll take a turn flying the front.
Yeah.
So a lot of people that I work with, when you do what I've done and you come out and admit to your own mental frailty at one stage in your life, people come to me with and just spill their life to me regularly.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I started to realize is nearly everybody that comes to me, they're not hopeless individuals with no potential or whatever. They're high performers often that have just flown the front so long that they're exhausted.
Yeah. Did you, when you mentioned that you spoke to Dr. Moot and you said to him that he saved your life, did you mean that? Were you that low?
Yeah, I think I was. Yeah. It's sort of like I had patches of time. I'd been the chairperson of the board of trustees at the local school. I'd been on the Lions Club for 18 years. I was a community leader. I was out there doing heaps of things. Mm-hmm. And I got that bad that I just shut myself in my office and drank.
Yeah.
But I never drank before 5 o'clock. But there was always somewhere in the world that was getting close to 5, so it gave me a pretty open license.
Yeah.
And my wife used to lie and cover for me. She'd just say I wasn't there. But I was there, all right. I was just hidden from life, trying to hide from my own shame.
Mm.
And I even got that desperate. One day I asked her if she'd mind leaving because she's the only person that was still yelling at me. She's trying to get me to bloody well do something to pick myself up. And I said to her, I think it'll be good if you leave. And she took a big breath and she looked at me and she said, you invited me into your life. We've had 3 children together. If you want to leave, there's the door. See you later.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that didn't go too well.
No. I mean, like I said,
we battled on, and then the day that Moot spoke, the guy that had taken me down eventually brought me home. I just wanted to go home and get started. And about 3:30 in the morning, Wendy came out to the office where I was working, trying to figure out how I could move money to create the opportunity to bring the new process in. I already knew how to grow lucerne. I just had to figure how I was going to do it. And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm building a new dream."
Yeah.
I didn't realize how successful it would be. But in life, there's often, and all of us will face it, you come up to a signpost and one road has average and the other one has memorable. And I saw that signpost and I thought, I don't want to go down the average road anymore. I've had enough of this. I want to have a memorable life. At least if I have a go, I know that I will have tried.
Yeah.
And the 4 years was the toughest 4 years of my life. But I had hope, you see, that was the difference.
Yeah, so kept you going. The image of New Zealand man, Colin Meads type thing, the strong, silent type standing on a mountaintop. You know, when you talk about this mental health and depression, do you get a positive reaction from people?
Oh, yeah, like a few years ago, our legendary All Black John Kirwan came out and said he suffered from depression, and he wrote a book, All Blacks Don't Cry.
Yeah.
He admitted to the fact that a lot of the days when he was supposedly a superstar hero, he'd go back to his hotel and ball his head off.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we've got I now speak all over New Zealand to all sorts of groups. I recently did an address to the Hurricanes rugby team who came second in the Super Rugby competition this year. Mm-hmm. And a couple of the week afterwards, Nihi Milne-Scudder, who's the current All Black, came out and admitted to his own frailty. So what we've got in New Zealand is we've got a road toll of about 300 people, 320 people a year, and a suicide toll of 660.
Yeah.
And most New Zealanders don't realise that. We're running around trying to do everything we can to save people from dying on the roads. But I can tell you, I get involved with a lot of families who have had a suicide, and people take that far harder.
Yeah.
And yet we're lost for solution, but I'm not.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us about the resilient farmer then? Resilience. What's resilience to you in farming?
Resilience is having the capacity to manage yourself in a wonderful way and be happy and thriving in all the cycles that you could generally expect. It's the ability to bounce forward from your troubles. So, you know, we've had three massive earthquakes where I live. Kaikoura earthquake was the last one. Thank God we had the other two before, because that got rid of a lot of the loose stuff and we were better prepared. But it was a 7.8, and that's the third biggest earthquake ever recorded in human times. That absolutely wrecked our farm, lifted the farm 2 metres and moved it 5 metres north in 2 minutes. So you can imagine lying in bed, hugging your wife, feeling what that was like. Bloody bits flying off the house, and it was just ridiculously bad. I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
12 days after that, we had our farm back in full production mode. Our houses, we've only just settled insurance, so this is 18 months ago now. We've only just settled insurance. We've got a lot of work to do there, but we had everybody back at work and safe and warm and fed.
Yeah.
And that's a resilient response. People keep telling me, "Oh, gee, you come to Scotland just at the right time. Everyone's had such a bad time," and that we've tended to neglect the capacity that we have as human beings to get better organised and give people the tools of self-management in these kind of areas. So, yeah, resilience is something which I work on every day. It's not something that you get up on Monday morning and think, "I'm going to be a resilient person by Friday." Resilience is a state of mind. It's a readiness. It's a determination. It's an enthusiasm. It's a process which it's a mindset, I guess.
Yeah.
You have resistant mindsets and resilient mindsets. Shit happens to both of them. Both lots of people get shit. The resistant mindset says, this is a problem. The resilient mindset says, where's the opportunity?
Yeah.
So no matter how hard somebody stands on my toe, I will know I move to the opportunity mode just immediately.
You talk about three key pillars to sustainable resilient farming. Could you explain those, please?
You've got your social pillar, which is your well-being, your capacity to build relationships and your capacity to thrive and enjoy the world that's around you. You've got the environmental pillar, which is the physical land and landscapes and all those things that make the place where you live and work such a beautiful and exciting place. And then, of course, with that, and equal, they're all equal. Without one, you had it. The other one's your financial pillar. So you have to have an idea, a solution, and a business which has got the capacity to generate the results that go with the other. And going through a life at any given time, any of those pillars can be challenged.
Yeah.
But a resilient mindset defaults to the good oil. How can I fix this? What's the solution? So I don't know whether you've ever heard of neuroplasticity. 10 years ago, we basically thought that a human mind would grow as a child to a certain point, and then from then on, as you either got hits on the head or drank more alcohol or took more drugs or whatever, you slowly killed off your potential to live.
Yeah.
And when you got old, you got degenerative diseases and your brain just slowly frizzled up until one day you'd go putt.
Yeah.
We now know that the brain, neuroplasticity is the term which applies to the ability of the brain to grow and develop at any stage. And I believe that's what happened to me. When I got excited again about life, my capacity to learn and grow just started to increase. So everybody knows that positive people are wonderful to be around. And I run from negative people because they can drag you down. But I'd just like to take a second, if I could, to explain how that works.
Yeah.
The brain is like any other part of our body. It likes to do things the easiest way. Mm-hmm. So it creates highways to the various parts. So you've got your lizard brain, which is your sad place. If you constantly have negative thoughts, if you think that the world owes you and, you know, everyone else has done better than me and anyway, it's too bloody late for me and I wish I hadn't started in this world. That stuff just keeps transferring to the sad part of your brain, and eventually, if enough of that sad messaging is going there, the amygdala lights up and starts producing chemicals which make you feel really crook. So that's what drives you to depression, constant reinforcement of negativity. On the other side of things, if you're a positive thinker and you're constantly thinking of opportunity and things that make you feel hope and excitement, the roadways, the channels, the messaging channels going to your happy place, your prefrontal cortex, they slowly become more used and easier to use. So the brain will naturally start channeling, because it's lazy, the information to the happy place. And the road to the sad place will close down. It'll only be opened up if something really bad happens. And so, you know, if you explain to people how that works, they start to realize the importance of taking a lighter but more accurate approach to life, where you get involved in learning, where you keep yourself fit, and where you engage with people who have got lots of purpose in them.
Yeah. So, yeah. When did you start trying to help other people with this? When you were going through the tough times and you regained your focus and you were moving on, when did you think, yeah, this is working for me, it can work for other people, and I'm going to help them?
In 2004, our son came back on the farm in 2002, and that made a huge difference to me. I immediately felt like more supported.
Yeah.
And then in 2004, we set up a process called the Scarborough Flaxman Soil Conservation Group, and I became the chairman of that. And that ran for 4 years. And I sort of started speaking then, and it just sort of – I started connecting with people. And in 2008, we had a field day, which we named Beyond Reasonable Drought. And 420 people came to the farm for that field day like there'd never been in New Zealand for years, a farming field day that had attracted so many people. And I didn't actually have a lot to say that day. I just hosted it, and it bloody near killed me because our resources were so overtaxed. The toilets, the marquee was the biggest one we could find in the South Island. There was over 100 four-wheel drives. That's just four-wheel drives. Did a motorcade round the farm. They were going into one farm, still coming out of another. It was absurd. The hotel proprietors in Kaikoura put a champagne breakfast on the beach down there of all these farmers heading north. That was the closest town from the south. So they were already pretty buoyant mood by the time they got there. And that shortly after that, we were awarded a green ribbon for our work for the Ministry of Environment for turning pretty trashed land into gold. And, of course, just from that, I just kept getting more and more requests to speak. And it felt right for me because the people had paid for our recovery.
Yeah.
And it felt my father, who was the navigator in the Lancaster bomber, he had a great saying: we are each given two hands, one to help ourselves and one to help our others. And by this stage, our farm was starting to thrive and excel. And it's a poor, poor heart that doesn't share the gain, especially when you got it in that way, with those around you.
Yeah.
And after a few years, I started getting wildly frustrated because I couldn't see enough change. I'm a person, when I see something, if I only need to see it and I'll know, yes, I'll do that, bang, and it's done. But I can see other people were saying, oh, it's great what you've done, you know, it's awesome what you've done. But they weren't doing it. And I think, why? Why wouldn't they get a tenfold increase in their per hectare in their returns for such a small investment?
Yeah.
And it was then that I realized that I was pushing in the wrong place. I was trying to change people's thinking so that they would change their actions. But then I decided I need to change what people believe. And it was about then that I started to realize I needed to front up and tell people about my time in that dark place. And when I disclosed that on the country radio program, which I do a fortnightly stint on for the last 5 or 6 years, they got the biggest response in the history of that program. Their emails, their phone just got blocked, as did mine. People ringing up saying, my husband, my wife, my brother, my uncle, my neighbor. Thank God somebody's lanced this boil. And so I started working on people's belief system. What do you believe? Because if you change people's belief system and they believe that they can win, or if they believe that there's a better way of doing things, they'll go out and do it. I've been progressively building from being the most isolated and sad little man New Zealand had in farming to probably way in advance of the most networked. And I've got so many wonderful and amazing friends all over the world, and they've become my source of richness.
And that must be, you must be very proud of that, of the amount of people you've helped.
I get emotional when I talk about this. I get stuff happen all the time. Since I launched my book last year, every day, I get people contacting me about something. And I was I did a book launch tour in New Zealand, and I was in Oxford in Canterbury. And I got to the end of my presentation, and a lady at the back of the room said, Doug, do you work with young people? And I was just about to answer, and a young girl from the front seat jumped up and grabbed the microphone. And she said, Doug saved my life.
Jeez.
And there was 90-odd people there, and they just went stony silent. So I knew the girl was there, and I knew that I'd worked with her, but I didn't realise that it was quite where she'd put it. But she said, if it wasn't for Doug, I wouldn't be here. And she was at university, and she'd gone to student health. And they said, what's the matter? And she said, I'm feeling suicidal. And they said, have you tried suiciding? And she said, no. And they said, well, all of our people are busy. You'll just have to go on the waiting list. And so she rang me, and I spent a whole day working with her on the phone, and eventually managed to get other people from Lincoln University to take some notice and help her. And she now lives a very productive life. But on that day, she didn't have anything left in the tank to drive her enthusiasm for life. And then I was at a there was a drought in Southland, which Southland never gets droughts, and it didn't look that dry to me. But I went down there and did a series of talks. And I was at one, and after I finished, I get queues of people wanting to talk to me when I'm finished. And this big guy came along with his 18-year-old son, and he said, "Can I talk to you over here?" And so we moved aside a bit, and I always know when people say that, that I've got something big coming. Mm-hmm. And he had a short-sleeved shirt on, and he pulled his shirt up, and there was a black dog tattooed onto the top of his arm. And I said to him, "Is that what I think it is?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Doug, I had a fully optioned plan to take my own life. I had the suicide note written. I knew exactly how I was going to do it. And I decided to read your book, and I got halfway through your book. And I thought, bugger it, I can follow this guy. I can get on with this." And he said, "I went down to the tattooist, and I said, I want a black dog tattooed on there." And he said, "These bits on the side," he said, "they're my angel wings, mate. That's you."
Yeah. Jeez.
And so, you know, like when you get that sort of response, I mean, I've had women ring me and say that there was one woman rang me one day, and she said, "I see you coming to Dannevirke. Could I ask if you could come to our farm? We would like to give you something." And I said, "Well, I've got a bit of time. I can come to your farm." And so I did. And when I got there, she said, "I bought your book for my husband for Father's Day." And when he opened it, he just went, "Huh," and threw it down on the table. And she said, "Every day when I made lunch and dinner, I'd put your book beside his place."
Yeah.
And he'd just push it aside and eat his dinner and carry on. And then one day she said, "I came in and it was missing." And I went up to our bedroom, and there he was on the bed crying, reading your book. And he said to her, "I've read a bit of this. And if I change my name, Doug's name, to mine, this is the story of me. I'm on my way, aren't I?" And she said, "You are. That's why I bought it." And she said, "I wondered if you could mentor us." And I said, "Yeah, I can." And she said, "We've got a 1,000 dairy cows and a very, very profitable business and a lot of debt. And my husband's always under pressure. And when he read your book, he realized that he needed to change, and we just need a hand to change." And I helped them to understand that he was flying the front, and if without support. And they've set up a board. They've got a whole different approach. He gets his time off, and that business is flourishing. The last I heard, they just bought another runoff block. You know, improving our mental well-being, our emotional well-being, is the greatest trigger that New Zealand can play, and I suspect nearly every other Western world at the moment, for greater well-being.
Without a doubt. I mean, I in researching for this, I found a lot of stuff from your book, and there's six in your book. You mentioned six tips for a happier life, and it's connect, give, take notice, don't personalize problems that are not yours, keep learning, and be active. And when I read that, I actually ordered your book last night. I'm going to be reading it, and I'll, but that really struck a chord with me. It just made a lot of sense, those things.
It was an interesting process. I thought that my future was around speaking, and I enjoy speaking, and I get a real buzz out of presenting to people.
Yeah.
And I'm always trying to improve myself. And then one day our biggest publishers, Penguin Random House, rang me up, and they said, we have been casting around the place looking for another book in the mental health space. John Kirwan's two books were so popular, and they published both of those. And every time we look for somebody, your name keeps coming to the top of the pile. Would you be interested? And I said, "Yeah, I've thought about doing it, but I was nearly bottom of English in every class I ever went, and I don't know how to do it." And they said, "Well, you don't need to worry about that. We'll do all that." And they said, "We'll put you through the process." Anyway, they did. And I worked with an amazing lady called Margie Thompson. She did Kirwan's two books and did some other notable work in New Zealand. And we were going along great. Maggie was awesome. Just the most clever and wonderful young woman that you could ever get. She lives in the heart of Auckland as an extreme green, working with an old blue cocky from way up in the hills. And I thought, boy, this is gonna be an interesting match. But you know, she was such a professional bird, and
yeah.
When I googled her, there she was, save the whales and save this and save everything else. Well, I think I'm a green, but I just don't go out in the street and wave my bloody arms about it. And anyway, we worked away, and we had 4 weeks work to do, 4 weeks to do 5 weeks work. And then her brother died over here in England of an aneurysm. And so she had 10 days, flew over here, had his funeral, loved brother, and flew back. And that put a lot of acid on us. And there's a piece in the middle of that book, which is not as strong as we'd like. I said to her, Maggie, we've got a back off this. You just can't, that's too tough on you. We've just got to say to the publishers, we just can't complete. And she said, Doug, I love working with you. It's cathartic for me. And she said, oh, we will complete. And we did. And we supplied the work to the publishers. And 2 days later, they rung me and said, you guys have written a bestseller. I said, I read it myself. When I read my own book, I cried the whole way through. I've never had my life presented to me in that way.
Yeah.
And it was such an emotional business. It was the best helicopter view I've ever had of my own life.
Yeah.
You see, when you look in the mirror, you don't see your life. But when you spill it out to a lady like that, she just about ran out of recording ability because I was such a free runner. And I said to the Penguin, you know, I just don't think that's a bestseller. And they said, well, if it's not, it's the first time that our group of professional readers would be wrong. And they said they rate every book, five of them, 1 to 5, and you got 5 fives.
Wow.
And it was their second best-selling book in New Zealand in the 12 months that it was released. I got beaten by a woman with a cookbook. I'll knock her off her perch with my next one. Yeah. You notice there's a competitive edge in this man.
I can tell that, yeah. I mean, one of the things that did jump out to me as well when I was reading the 6 tips was that when you say about be active, and you talked about when you started playing squash and it made you getting sweaty and physically exhausted, made you feel mentally stronger. And that's something that struck a chord with me, because a few years ago I started running. Sometimes it's late at night after a long day, but it's hugely helped me in that regard.
Yeah, you know, like human beings weren't supposed to do the work that we're trying to make ourselves do now, and that's why that's one of the reasons. There's a lot of reasons we're eating rubbish food as well. Our sad Western diet has destroyed our brains. There's a whole lot of things that are doing it, but we sure as hell, smart people are starting to really wake up and realize that having a healthy mind is a huge part, and keeping active and fit is a huge part of it. When I'm presenting on the stage, I say to them, when you know, keep active, and then I add the point, Wendy always tells me, don't stand side on when I add that, but... I've got a mountain bike, but it's got a little electric motor on it as well, which I can charge up if an 18-year-old goes past me up on the hill. I can tickle it up a bit and say, see you later, son. This is what you get when you got a bit richer and you can afford just to keep your ego in place. I either walk an hour, run a bike an hour, or go to the gym for an hour every day when I possibly can. And that's one of the things I'm really grateful for, the people that have organized this tour. They've given me the space to have my happy time.
Yeah.
And John Kirwan and I do quite a bit of work together at times, and he is as huge on that as well. He's found that he puts himself first, which is something we've been taught not to do. But if you want a happy life, be strong yourself so you can be strong for others. And looking after yourself is emotionally is hugely about feeling good. I've got a son. He lives in Western Australia, our youngest son, and he holds the Western Australian record for running 24 hours. He ran 240.4K in 24 hours.
Jeez.
So you can see, you can see that madness doesn't stay just with the father.
definitely.
At the start of this, you asked me, what am I doing in Scotland? And I want it. Not everybody. Some people will look at you and say, oh, that guy's had a breakdown. He's a nutcase. He's hopeless or whatever. But I want to create an environment and a world where people realize that you can have a broken leg or you can have a broken mind and they're both fixable.
Yeah.
And that can happen. Those two things can happen to pretty much anyone, anytime, if you get the right circumstances. The difference between a broken leg is if you've got a broken leg, everyone can see what's happened, and the doctor will be able to tell you exactly how long it's going to take to fix and what you've got to do. With a broken mind, it's a bit different. But the thing with a broken mind is we always think they'll fix themselves, but seldom does that happen. Without changing the platform or the mode of operandi, you have little chance. And if you're really bad, you'll probably need medicating so that you can exact the changes and have half a chance. But we need to just relax and say, well, you know, like imagine if we got all the they tell me in New Zealand that one in every four people in New Zealand will have a period of depression at some stage in their life. So that's a quarter.
Jeez. It's a huge number, isn't it?
At any given time, I get contacted by people all the time. And, you know, when I came out and told people that with my process, I got rings from some of the biggest CEOs of the major agricultural companies saying, our company wants to help you. Mm-hmm. And I said, what with? And they said, well, with whatever you're doing. And I say, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm still just I just came out and said I had a period of time. I haven't got any program or anything like that. But when I need money to do stuff, I know where to go. Yep. And one of the reasons it's so readily coming is because those men and women are so grateful that somebody's speaking about it on their account.
Yeah, okay. And in 2017, you're awarded the New Zealand Order of Merit for services to agriculture and mental health. That must have been an extremely proud moment for your family.
It was. I'm the product of a system that worked for me, and so it was an award which was given to me. I've always seemed to get hold of the shiny area of the stage.
Yeah.
But there was a massive number of people, including my own amazing wife and family, that helped nurture me back.
Yeah.
And forgave me for some of the stuff that went down when I was in my bad place. Yeah. You know, like the press people aren't very nice to live with, and I wasn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, just coming to grips, I can't change my past, but I sure as hell can lift my future. And I guess we've had a lot of pride zones. We got the green ribbon in 2008. The next year, we were made a Landcare ambassador in New Zealand by the New Zealand Landcare Trust. 2010, we were the South Island Farmer of the Year. 2011, we won the Marlborough Environment Award for our farm. And 2012, I was the New Zealand Agricultural Communicator of the Year. And I was incredibly proud of that because it had only ever been won. It had been won by a farmer before, but he had a radio show. And it had only ever been won by television programs and journos and the like before. So, but, man, I've done a lot of talking since then. So I think the competition's given up when they get a guy that can talk as much as me.
So where can people listen? Where can they get hold of the book?
The book depository online. It's online. It's probably the best way to. I don't think anyone's actually physically selling it in the UK. But I was staying with Willie Part at Garda Shields, and he was in Dunedin, and they were going to do something, and it was. He said, "I've never seen rain like it." He said, "It rained and rained and rained and rained," and he said, "I thought I'd go and get a book," and so he said, "I went down to the bookstore," and he said, "I don't usually read a lot of books," and he said, "I saw your book and I read the back page. I took it home," and he said, "I didn't go to sleep until I'd finished reading it. I could not put it down."
Yeah,
and he said, "From that time, I always wanted to meet you." I wanted to meet you, and you know, like John Scott and all the other people that have helped put this together. My book is the New Zealand New Zealand government have launched a mental health inquiry, and the head of that is a guy called Ron Patterson, and a friend of his who's a farmer I read the book and rung Ron up and said, you're doing this mental health inquiry for New Zealand. I think you should read this book. And Ron got halfway through reading it, and he sent an email to all the other people on the commission and said, before we meet again, read this book. And then they sent me an email and said, well, we actually want you to appear with us. So I went up to the North Island to a town and spent a day with them. So it's now being seen as a useful resource in schools and all sorts of places. I had no idea. You know, it's an interesting. You just don't know what your life's going to do. But I'm so pleased that I wrote me book.
Yeah. So yeah, and your website is resilientfarmer.co.nz for anyone listening. And as I said, I spent a couple of hours watching you speaking on YouTube the other night. So anyone listening, do check that out as well. So, Doug, I always end these with five quick daft questions. So if you're ready, I'll hard-hitting questions. I'm sure you can cope with them, but if you're ready, we'll fire in with those.
Yeah, no, ready, as good as gold.
Okay, what's your all-time favourite song?
Stairway to Heaven, Led Zeppelin. I used to love that when I was 18 years old or so, and it's just such a durable song.
Brilliant choice.
Love it, yeah. Absolutely love it.
Great choice. If you could have dinner and a conversation with anyone from history, who would it be and why?
Nelson Mandela.
Oh, that's a great choice. Have you read Long Walk to Freedom?
Yeah, I have. And there's something about that man, the fact that he could have what was done to him and come out with a clear heart. And one of the learnings of my life is don't carry stuff you don't need to carry, or you'll just wreck yourself. You don't. Vengeance and stuff like that is just a rubbishy thought. Yeah. And cut loose the things that you can't control and the things that you don't need to carry, and spend your energy on the joyous things that you can control and you can carry. Your circle of influence is the place to spend your life.
Okay. What tool, gadget, or piece of equipment could you not manage without?
This is embarrassing, and I'm pleased my wife's not right here listening to me, but my cell phone or computer. That's embarrassing because I'm better than that. But when I thought about that, it's where it is. The kind of work that I do, I have to be all over those tools.
A lot of people listening will agree. If you could go back and give just one piece of advice to yourself as a young man, what would it be?
Slow down and form a flying V. Yeah. Look at geese and ask yourself, why do they do that? And then make your own V. Get the people in your team that you need to have there. Build relationships with them when things are good. And when things go bad, as they invariably will, you know who to ring.
Yeah, okay. And then lastly, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on social media, who would it be and why?
It'll be a psychologist and rural support, a supporter, Dennis Hoiberg from Adelaide in Australia, South Australia. He runs a process called Lessons Learned, and Dennis has been one of the most inspirational people. In life, you need to find your why. And your why, if you stand there with your arms spread up and your feet together, that is a why. And the center of your why is your head and heart. If you get your head and heart in the right place, the rest of life will be easy. Dennis is the most awesome, awesome man to follow. He's just full of wisdom.
Cool. I will check him out. All right, then, Doug, thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy tour schedule to talk to us today. It's hugely appreciated. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much, Will. Awesome.
Yeah, and good luck with everything you're doing, and thank you for inspiring so many farmers and people across the world.
That's my pleasure, and of course, they also inspire me.
Okay, and to everyone at home, thanks for listening, and see you next time. If you're feeling generous, please give this a share or retweet on social media. If you feel like leaving the podcast a review on iTunes, that is also a huge help. And if you can make it funny, I might even read it out on a future podcast. Also, the podcast has now been downloaded in 82 different countries, would you believe? And I'm giving a shout out to a different country every week. This time it's India, a growing number of listeners. So a big hello if you're listening there. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night. We'll be right back.